Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Candace Cushing and the Lost Tomb of Cleopatra by Georgette Kaplan, narrated by Abby Craden. Time laughs at all things, but the pyramids laugh at time. Arab proverb. Prologue. Dubai, United Arab Emirates, back when music didn't suck. The Burj Al Arab was the third tallest hotel in the world, and too good for the mainland. A bridge curved off the beach to an artificial island where the main mast of the building sloped up almost 700 feet to the world-famous helipad that had been converted into a tennis court for a recent match between two Grand Slam winners. If Easy Nevada fell off the building now, it would take almost 17 seconds for gravity to turn her into a pancake. This far up, the ground stretched outwards, as unreal as a mirage. Nevada wondered if this was how the rich always saw the world. Buildings were models, and the ocean was a painting with speedboats flittering through it like insects. Just flecks of white on the endless blue vista of Jumeirah Beach. And people were less than nothing, specks, static, not even visible to the naked eye. Killing one wouldn't even be a conscious act. From here, it would be like swatting a gnat. Nevada looked over her shoulder as a helicopter approached, its looping curves doing their best to turn the ungainly vehicle into something ergonomic. It mostly succeeded. The Sikorsky S-76C++ rode down to the helipad like a magic carpet. Holding the bowling bag away from her body, she watched the door slide open and steps unfurl. An Indian man disembarked. She raised her voice. "Send the chopper back up. I don't know what you're planning on using this for, but I'm guessing you'd rather it be near Mint." The man complied by waving off the helicopter. It took off in a gust of backwash from its rotors. Nevada shifted her weight as the wind tore at her body, and she saw the man stumbling about before he got his footing. He shook his head and ran his hand through his hair, then cracked his neck as the Sikorsky departed.
"Easy, Nevada. Hi. Big fan. What are you doing on the roof? Was the room not to your liking?"
"It was tops. I just prefer my doors to lock from the inside." He was a tall, lanky man with chocolate-brown hair arranged in a pompadour and a neatly trimmed beard compensating for a rather weak chin. The excessive length of his arms and legs were left exposed by the short white pants and polo shirt he wore, Air Yeezys on his feet and athletic socks crawling up his skinny shins. Nevada could see the power in his limber body. He had a duffel bag slung over one shoulder, and despite its evident weight, lifted it like it was nothing. In his other hand, he held a tennis racket. Long, jaunty strides carried him across the rooftop to her. When he was close enough, Nevada turned to face him, and he stopped in his tracks.
"And the man who picked you up at the airport?" he asked. "Courteous, I trust."
"5 stars, just like the guys who picked me up in Belize. In the future, though, I'd prefer a company car to a chauffeur. I kind of like to be in the driver's seat."
"Oh, but I've noticed you have a few reckless driving citations on your record. We wouldn't want any harm to come to you before we've concluded our business."
"Don't worry about me. My last fortune cookie said I was going to die at the age of 92, murdered by a jealous husband."
"An all too common fate."
She shrugged. Didn't say it was my husband. You're Singh?"
"Akbar Akkad Singh, and it is a true pleasure to meet you."
He came forward, holding out his hand, and Nevada held the bag higher. Business before pleasantries. I totally understand. Very good business practice. No chat, chat, chat. Let's talk money." Bending to one knee, he set down the duffel bag. The zipper rasped open and he spread both hands. Inside was the root of all evil, enough to need a lot of rubber bands.
"A fair price and good cardio if you're planning on lugging this all the way to the nearest bank. I know. I find online banking is just the worst."
His voice was light and high-pitched, with a faint, pleasant English accent that Nevada imagined had come straight from Oxford, overseas education. The jubilant excitement he spoke with, though, would fit in better with a tour guide at Disneyland, along with the open expressiveness of his face. It gave him a handsome boyishness, despite the gray beginning to infiltrate his hair. "Slide the money over here," Nevada instructed. "Then take a few steps back." Singh gave the bag a heave. It jostled its way over the hissing concrete,
and came to a stop a few feet from Nevada. She looked at Singh, and he backed up, playing with the tennis racket for lack of anything else to do with his hands. Nevada checked over the money. There were no tricks that she could see, no newspaper or ones inside the stacks of cash, just $100 bills from top to bottom. She counted them, stack by stack, and it quickly became obvious that this was more money than she'd ever seen in her life. She should have closed the zipper, hefted the bag, and walked. But that much money had its own gravitational pull. She was almost in awe of it. God, she'd won the fucking lottery, and she hadn't even bought a ticket. Just stumbled across a souvenir she thought would look cool next to her stereo.
"Love your work, by the way," Singh said. "I mean, here I was wondering where the hell you'd put my skull. We were all wondering. I was like, where is it? Where'd she put it? Giving it to someone else, putting them up in my own hotel and picking it up from them when you were ready. That's classic. All my guys. They thought you had a safety deposit box so that you'd buried it in some geocache, but here it was, right under my nose the whole time."
"Yeah." Then I set a towel on fire and walked out when the fire alarm unlocked the door.
"That's all right. We expect the towels to be stolen. And the elevator?"
Singh wagged a finger at her.
"Guests aren't supposed to have access to the roof."
Swiped an access card off the maid. "You aren't supposed to hold people prisoner in a hotel," Nevada chided right back. "The routines are posted on the website."
"Prisoner? In the only 7-star hotel in the world? We let you have all the premium cable channels."
Nevada closed her eyes and forced herself to review her options. Money didn't spend unless she could walk away with it. The helicopter might have left, but she didn't doubt Singh had a rogues gallery packing the stairwell, ready to chop her to pieces and mail her wherever the postage was cheapest. He might give the order, he might not. But Nevada couldn't see much of a play besides assuming he wouldn't. She could always shove that tennis racket down his throat later. She set the bowling bag down and gave it a shove down the rooftop. Singh snatched it up the moment it was within reach, slipping and falling to his knees in his exuberance, ripping open the bag without bothering with the zipper. He looked inside, then turned his face heavenward, consumed with relish, clutching the bag.
"Oh, it's real. It is real. You could just tell. Well, maybe not you. I can tell. Do you know what this is, Easy Nevada? Do you have any idea what we have?"
"World's greatest bong." Singh looked at her. As open as his gaze was, Nevada had a hard time parsing it. Was he looking at her as a child looked at a new toy, as a player contemplated his next move, or even as a man stared at a beautiful woman?
"Fancy a game?"
"This before or after you show me your etchings?" Singh reached slowly into his pocket, then brought out a remote control. He pressed it, and the surface of the helipad irised open. In its place, a tennis court rose into view, the netting taut between them. A second tennis racket and a tube of balls lay on the ground. Nevada wondered if Singh had planned for this specifically, or if it was one of many outcomes he'd prepared for, and which was more intimidating.
"A nice match," Singh said,
bouncing on his heels, then launching into a series of stretches. All that was missing was a boombox playing YMCA.
"Shake off the cobwebs. Get the blood pumping. A little more oxygen to the brain and we can discuss business. It's the 21st century. Who wants to talk shop over a lousy game of golf?"
"I thought our business was concluded," Nevada said.
"Only if you want it to be."
Nevada eyed the roof access door. Either there was a kill squad waiting down the stairs, or there wasn't. She didn't see how it decreased her odds to hear him out. One game. Singh set the skull down by the net. Nevada set her money down on the other side. She chopped her racket back and forth in a few practice swings. Her arm registered no aches or pains, just tendons stretching supplely and muscles flexing smoothly. Singh served. It was an easy serve, and Nevada returned it with equal ease. Singh barely moved from his sphinx-like waiting to send the ball rebounding back. Nevada only had to move a little more to hit it herself. In the crisp, frail-seeming air at this height, the sound of the ball being struck was as regular as the ticking of a metronome. It didn't echo, of course, not this high up. Instead, the noise seemed to hang suspended in the air, uninterrupted, not lost in any background noise as it dwindled into nothing. Nevada thought uncomfortably of a soul leaving a body, or a child leaving home. As if sensing how Nevada's mind had wandered, Singh returned to the ball with sudden savagery. It soared past her, out into the dizzying drop that separated this perch from solid ground, and she watched it fall into non-existence. She remembered stories of how you could drop a penny from the Empire State Building and it could shoot right through a man's skull. If that were true, she wondered what a tennis ball at this height could do. Maybe total a parked car.
"Have you ever read about myths, Easy? All of them have a common factor. Hercules, Achilles, Xena. They're all about immensely powerful beings right here on Earth, capable of amazing feats. And not just one. No, not the monotheism that came when man stripped his beliefs down to make them smaller and more acceptable. There were Hopantheans, an entire race of gods. And where do you think they all went?"
Nevada held up her hands, offered cigarettes, and said they'd be right back. Singh shrugged and went to get another ball.
"Honestly, I don't know either. 15 love.
He pointed his racket at the skull.
"That's all that's left of whatever they were. That and 11 more. Proof that every story ever told about gods and goddesses were based in fact."
He served fast and harsh, and Nevada broke a sweat for the first time as she returned it. Singh was going harder now. Nevada ricocheted his shots back, but it was like playing against a wall. Wherever she sent the ball, he was there, and the ball only came at her faster and faster. He'd been toying with her before, and that only made Nevada more incensed.
"I know the rich are eccentric," she said, "but wouldn't it be easier for you to get into green coffee extract?"
Singh was a machine, mercilessly hammering the ball back.
"I don't care about losing weight, Easy. I care about the future of humanity. According to legend, if all 12 of the skulls are brought together, the man who does it will be granted one wish."
Nevada smashed the ball hard, sending it almost whistling at his face.
"Yeah, I can see how you'd want to improve your circumstances."
Singh knocked the ball back in a wide arc over the net. Nevada made a run for it, saw the ball sloping down past the rim of the court, and skidded to a stop before she could reach it. She saw the ball graze the edge before it dropped away into nothingness.
"Daddy love," Singh said.
He already had another ball.
"I've been searching for the skulls for years. You aren't even looking and you find one. That's not coincidence. You are fated for this search."
He bombarded her with his next serve, the ball whistling through the air. Nevada threw herself across the court. This time it wouldn't get away from her. She was too damn tired of being Singh's straight man as he amused himself. Coming up to the drop, she got under the ball and snapped her racket to knock it back past Singh while she teetered on the edge. The fall gaped open underneath her, and Nevada felt like laughing.
"Try flying coach sometime. The universe will seem a lot more random."
She recovered her balance, taking a step back from the edge to see Singh throwing his racket down in a fit of pique.
"Enough games," he shouted, coming to the net. "I want you to find the other 11 skulls. For each one you deliver, I will pay you 10 times what's in that bag. Money like that can open doors for you and your son."
Nevada felt her grip tightening on her racket.
"You say 1 skull's worth 10 times what's in that bag to you?"
"Oh, yes."
"Then I'm going to need at least 5 more bags.
Singh smiled in agreement, a childish grin, and Nevada pictured a little boy in her head. Nevada didn't have a picture of her kid. What she did have was a CT scan. A cross-section of a brain maybe the size of a bocce ball, incomprehensible in its artistic swells and curves, all except for the ghostly white lump that she could understand. He was her son, and like her, he was imperfect, with a fatal flaw she'd passed on in her blood, the single inheritance he'd taken with him to his new family. And now, like a cuckoo's egg ready to hatch, it swelled and blistered and turned inward. The doctors could irradiate it, but there was no operation, no cure, unless someone made one, unless someone paid for one. Nevada felt unnatural. Didn't every animal care for its young? Every beast but man? She'd given him up, abandoned him to a better life. Harry Calhoun. That's who he was now. And his new family had 2 mortgages and an empty college fund, trying to keep him alive. God, what a con she'd pulled. She told herself she was a heartless bitch. and she tried very hard to make that true. Chapter 1. Within the mud and thatched roof of a tukul, David Pike awoke covered in sweat. It had nothing to do with the nearly 100-degree heat, and everything to do with the evil that had entered the room. A white man in his mid-40s, Pike still looked nearly every inch the biker he had been before hearing the call to come to Africa. His hulking body was stout, with the solid bulk of a pot belly like a diesel fuel tank doing little to reduce the physicality of his bear-like 6'2" frame. A long mane of black hair flecked with gray went down to his shoulders, while the many biker tattoos along his arms and neck had long since been crowded out by ones showcasing crosses, Bible verses, and a select few faces of the Ubangi tribes that had become his adopted family. A horseshoe mustache and little shaven cheeks gave his wide, flat face an uncut appearance, like rock that had been hewn into the rough shape of a man, but no one had finished chiseling out the details. Blinking blearily, he saw a face beyond the mosquito netting that surrounded his bed. There was something strange about it, some trick of the eye that he couldn't yet sort out through the midnight shadows and moonlight seeping into the room. It wasn't until he wiped his face with his hand that he realized what was wrong. There was no face, only an invisible force pressing through the gossamer net, leaving an imprint of a man's features where none existed. Pike backed away from it, nearly off his mattress, feeling now what his animal senses had been warning him about when he'd awoken. Turning his head the other direction in an instinctive search for a way to flee from this evil presence, he saw another face there as well, crowding into the mosquito netting. There was another next to it, and another, a legion of faces disturbing the windy sway of the netting. He groped underneath the bed, searching for his flashlight and the desert eagle he always kept on hand when God said, "No, pray."
"Something's in the room with me,"
Pike replied. His hand was almost clawing at the dirt floor, trying to find a weapon. God spoke again, not more insistent. How could God be more or less insistent, but more resonant, more showing of his authority?
"Start praying now."
Pulling his hand away from the dirt like it had been bitten, Pike threaded his fingers together and prayed. He prayed for his soul, stained by the violence he had done and the crimes he had committed, for the lives of the children he had taken in at Camp Esau, for an end to the bloody war that had put them in danger and taken away so many of their parents, for all those he had harmed in his days as a lost sheep, and even those he had harmed since, trying to stop them from destroying this holy place and these loving people. He prayed long into the night, the wind stirring the mosquito net around him. Finally he slept, and when he woke, he wondered if it had been a dream. Then he looked at the ground. There was a perfect circle around his bed where the dirt floor was undisturbed. The unbroken boundary of that line fit exactly to the mosquito netting draped around his bed. Outside the circle, every inch of the dirt floor was covered in footsteps.
"What happened, Lord?"
he asked, his voice quivering.
"Satan was in this room last night. He tried to come for you, but I would not let him near."
The weight of history fell all over the earth, but perhaps was most keenly felt in the desert, where time itself crushed down the rock until it was pulverized into sand. The monotony was endless, each moment so identical to the next that Candace could have been trapped in a single second like an insect in amber and never notice it, never see any difference in the wind scouring the sands or the sun beating down with infinite heat, or the landscape stretching on in its barrenness until it felt like the whole world had become a wasteland. Thought itself was burned and blasted and dried up, even the simple hope of escape, until only the strongest survived, while lesser men were driven mad.
"I cannot believe you," Candace said.
"Really?" Nevada asked, lowering her sunglasses. "Candace, Sudan is old news. New Sudan now? South Sudan? It's a new chapter in our lives. Hell, it's a whole new book. And we're still doing the, 'Wow, Nevada, I can't believe you're doing something so shocking and inconsistent with social norms' thing. Move on, lady. I stopped calling you Candy.'
Yes, you've moved on to sweetie, darling, doll, and brown sugar. I'm so affectionate,"
Nevada said, raising her sunglasses back over her eyes. I thought you Europeans were into that. Let's review. When I went to sleep, because I've been driving the tank we're on for 10 hours straight, I assumed you'd be driving the tank.
There are sayings about assumption.
Instead, when I wake up, I find that you are sunbathing.
Oh, that reminds me.
Nevada turned over, prompting an almost instinctive averting of Candace's eyes.
What's your damage, sweetheart? I don't know if you've noticed the ratio of melanin between us, but clearly I need to tan more than you do.
Besides, we're still making good time. Ishmael's driving.
Yes, Ishmael's driving,
Candace emphasized, arms crossed.
Yeah, and he's doing a great job.
He's 12.
This is a valuable life skill he's picking up.
How to drive an M60 main battle tank?
Nevada turned onto her side. Well, you've got a point there. It is a pretty old model. But I think if he can figure this out, an M1 Abrams shouldn't be too hard.
Candace sat down on the turret with a sigh like a Zeppelin deflating.
Tell me we're almost there.
Yeah, yeah, any day now.
We reached this hunting lodge-turned-refugee camp that the boss made a big donation to. They put us up. Jacques gets there with the plane, we fly out, more crazy adventures and simmering sexual tension.
Nevada flopped down onto her belly again.
Hey, there's some suntan lotion in my bag. Could you put another layer on my back?
You brought suntan lotion on your tomb raiding. Of course you did. I'm not even surprised at this point.
See? New chapter, new book.
Stop that. You sound like Oprah before she's had her coffee.
Candace stood again, hovering over Nevada.
What do you mean? Hunting lodge turned refugee camp.
You're in my son.
Nevada.
Candace.
Nevada craned her neck to look up to her.
What? Some missionary operation. They'll even take the kids off our hands. I did ask.
Okay, Candace said,
sliding out of Nevada's sunlight.
What do you mean, okay?
Are you being funny? Candace asked.
No, you said it in this total Real Housewives way like it's not okay, but you're going to put up with it. You're not some Richard Dawkins type, are you?
No, I'm not Richard Dawkins. I have a sense of irony. What about you? You're not some focus on the family type.
Candace, I'm pretty much a sexy cat burglar. Clearly, I'm not the most religious person. But it's missionaries. Who has a problem with missionaries?
Well, the many millions of indigenous peoples around the world who are forced to convert on pain of death.
Don't worry, Nevada said condescendingly.
I'll defend you from the big bad youth pastors who don't want you to swear so much.
And a lot of them don't distribute relief so much as they throw around Bibles and socks.
Candace, we're doing the missionaries' position, and that's final.
Candace simmered for a moment on the pun she'd walked into.
I hate you.
But it's an erotic hate, like James Bond and the villain's sexy henchwoman.
I'm going back inside,
Candace said, pulling the hatch up.
So you're really not doing my back?
Nevada called after her. The hatch clanged shut.
Okay, send Uday up. He has strong hands.
Candace?
Hello?
It took a few more days of travel, but eventually, the unchallenged dominion of the Sahara Sands began to combat the plains and low hills of what locals called the Gaz. The two fought like weary, wounded soldiers with long stretches of gravel and jagged sandstone broken up by guerrilla attacks of wiry grass or thorny scrub, spreading over the gritty soil until it had taken over the horizon. After the sterility of the desert, it should have been a relief. But the weak and crippled attempts at growth only made the surroundings seem more lifeless. Bleached bones and desiccated corpses were the only landmarks, accompanied by dust devils clawing at the burning sands like red-handed murderers displaying their handiwork. The sun had disappeared behind evening clouds, and the heat was bleeding out of the sand like a fire guttering out when the tank came across a mother elephant and her fallen calf. The child was as big as a St. Bernard, but infinitely more ungainly. Like some cobbled-together toy, it refused to function, only stirring slightly as its mother pulled at it with her trunk. It was obvious to Candace that the calf was halfway to being another set of bleached bones, but Nevada stopped the tank, got out, and brought it water in an upside-down helmet. The calf only drank sparingly, but Nevada stayed beside it as ardently as its mother, encouraging it to drink more. The human children filed out to stretch their legs and relieve themselves, while Candace stayed on the tank in some parody of guardianship, keeping one eye on the children to ensure they wouldn't wander off
and another on Nevada. Riding in the tank, she felt like she was being shaken apart. The M60 wasn't much more comfortable when it was parked, but Candace appreciated the stillness. A week ago, she didn't think she had ever seen a tank in real life, or heard a gun go off, or seen any blood that hadn't come from someone's nose. She'd been an archaeologist, working on a dig site in Meroe. She'd been more worried about contaminating her findings than losing her life. Everything had changed so quickly that it hardly seemed real. More like some TV show where someone got bumped on the head and dreamt they were in the Wild West. The government of Sudan had been decapitated in a terrorist bombing. Another cell of that same terror network, the Comscene, had come to destroy Candace's dig. Nevada had saved her, then shanghaied her into an expedition inside the tomb her team had uncovered to find a treasure Nevada was set on claiming. There hadn't been any treasure, though. Only a clue to where it had been taken, to be buried in the tomb of Cleopatra herself. Calling on the resources of Nevada's mysterious employer, they'd finagled their way onto a train, evacuating refugees from Khartoum, which had been destroyed midway through the journey. Most of the refugees had been left to hike back to Khartoum, and an uncertain fate, while Nevada had used a tank they'd liberated from the Comscene to drive to safety in South Sudan, taking Candace, the wounded, and the children with her. Now the plan was to get the refugees to safety and set off on the second leg of this treasure hunt. Candace would find an archaeological treasure trove, with Nevada only taking one small trinket for her trouble. It felt like she'd sold her soul. Candace sometimes wished she'd stayed with her first instinct, to drug Nevada and leave her safely behind in the hotel in Khartoum while she went after the treasure, the find, herself. But she needed Nevada's street smarts as much as Nevada needed her expertise. And she wanted Nevada to save her kid, assuming he wasn't some con job. Of course, even if he wasn't, that hardly made things better. You weren't allowed to rob banks just because you donated the money to charity. In Candace's experience, people rarely acted according to justifications anyway. They acted according to their nature. Was the boy Nevada's justification, or an excuse for her to indulge in her nature? "And what's your nature, Candace Cushing?" she asked herself. "What is your justification? What is your excuse?" Something sparked at her eye, almost like a tear. Covering her eyebrows with the chop of her palm, she saw a metallic glimmer on the horizon with a dust storm behind it, some futile defiance of the sun, rising up to try and blot it out before being sucked away by indifferent winds. In that miasma of torn sands, the metal vehicle gleamed even brighter.
"Easy!" she cried. "We've got company!"
Nevada looked in Candace's direction, which brought her the sight of the woman standing on the tank's cupola, as if she needed to be any taller and pointing at the southern horizon, their destination. Nevada looked that way, and there it was, plain as day. And if there was one thing the Sahara had in stock, it was day. Nevada took her scope out of her pocket and looked through it.
"What you see?"
Candace called. Nevada adjusted the scope to bring the scene into focus.
"Tour bus!"
Distantly, Nevada heard the whoomp of sand compacting as Candace hopped down from the tank.
"Tour bus? What's a tour bus doing in a war zone?"
Nevada replaced the scope in her pocket.
"Maybe it's the economy tour."
She dropped her hand to the gun in her holster to check that its reassuring weight was still there. It wasn't her own pistol, but a revolver she'd taken off one of the Comscene on the train, so old that she didn't know the make or model, but it fired. An unfamiliar weight draped across her shoulders, and she looked up to see the mother elephant, its trunk outstretched to curl around her in some gesture of pachyderm emotion she refused to try to read into. Thankfulness or beseeching or even consoling. God, she didn't want to be one of those people called to pet their fur baby. Nevada pushed the trunk away.
"It's tough being a mom,"
she said as if she'd know, and walked back to the tank. She slid her dive knife out of its sheath, checking to make sure it would come out without a hitch, then pushed it back inside. Candace was standing in front of the tank, arms crossed, her strong features set with worry. Nevada emptied her own face of emotion, giving Candace a cheeky grin instead. Candace was a tough cookie, and she'd taken more than most, but that was no reason to throw anything at her that she didn't absolutely need to catch.
"Get everyone inside the tank," Nevada said confidently.
She took her revolver out and checked the chambers. 5 of the 6 were full. The chamber...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?